Jesus said, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy, where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Well, we're in the Sermon on the Mount, as many of you know. We're looking at this central passage that encapsulates Jesus' teaching from Matthew chapter 5 through to verse 7. And as we've been saying, this sermon is well known by people. You don't necessarily have to be a Christian or a churchgoer to know the Sermon on the Mount. It still has traction in wider society. When you quote the Sermon on the Mount, people often know that it's the words of Jesus. And that's why, as I said some weeks ago, that's why politicians like Barack Obama and others, not just him, of course, others often quote the Sermon on the Mount, quote Jesus' saying, because they want the support of Jesus, for some reason. They want the support of Jesus for their policies. It's not that they want to serve Jesus, they want Jesus to serve them. So they quote Jesus' words to, you know, say, well, this is what Jesus would have done. And they say that because, you know, the Sermon on the Mount still resonates in the wider society. But so it's well known. It's well known, but it's not known at the same time. It's a strange thing. You can know something well, but not know it. Because you may think you know something very well, but you don't know it at all. I think it was Alexander Pope, who once said, "A little knowledge is dangerous. It's apt to puff a man up." It's like teaching a teenager to drive, which I'm doing at the moment. They have 5 lessons. And all of a sudden they think they know everything. And they think that because they've had 5 lessons, it's quite all right for them to go out and drive 90 miles an hour up the motorway. A little knowledge, you see, makes them think they can do all sorts of things. It puffs people up. Francis Bacon also said the same. He said, a little philosophy, a little learning, inclines men's minds to atheism. A smattering of knowledge inclines men to unbelief. But he said, depth in philosophy brings men's minds about to religion. A little knowledge puffs up, a little knowledge leads to the deaths of teenagers in cars, a little knowledge leads men to unbelief. A superficial understanding of the Sermon on the Mount leads politicians to want to redefine age-old institutions like marriage, claiming that Jesus would support them. And that's why I think it's important that we spend some time in the Sermon on the Mount looking at it in some depth and in some detail. This will, first of all, if you're a Christian, will make you a real disciple or a better disciple of Jesus Christ. And if you're not Christian or you're not that familiar with the Sermon on the Mount, it'll get you to the heart of what Jesus is really saying. And in the passage today, in Matthew 6, we are getting to the heart of what Jesus was driving at. He says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal. Store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." So Jesus is driving at your heart. He's concerned about your heart. He's concerned about your ultimate values. He's concerned about the things that are most precious and dear to you. And he says, therefore, where your treasure is, there is your heart. So where is your heart, ladies and gentlemen? Where is your treasure? What are you really valuing in this life? What are you really trusting? Jesus is very concerned about this. And the reason he's very concerned about this is because on the day of judgment, what Jesus is saying is that the disposition and inclination of your heart will ultimately and finally and completely define and determine your relationship with the one living and true God. Now, I can't get more serious than that. Don't think Jesus could either, really. I could actually fine-tune it. I could make it more direct, even more personal, because what Jesus is talking about is not your relationship to God, although he is talking about that. What he's ultimately saying is, what is your heart's relationship with me? With me. How do you evaluate, how do you value me? Because your relationship to me will ultimately determine your everlasting destiny. That's serious. Serious. And so Jesus is going after our hearts. And he does that because what he's trying to do is trying to wean us off what our hearts naturally go after, what your heart and my heart naturally goes after. Because he says our desires, our hearts, what you treasure, what you value, showcase and display your ultimate concerns. And so he starts to go after our hearts. And he starts to go after it negatively. He starts off negatively, doesn't he? He says, do not store up for yourselves. That's negative. Do not. Don't do that. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. And then he says that. He says, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth. And then because he's going after your mind, well, he's going after your heart, but your mind is one aspect of your heart. Your mind, your rational thinking, your ability to think and reason is part of your overall heart, you see. So Jesus says, I'm going to give you a reason. I'm not just going to say something. I'm not just going to say, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth. I'm going to give you a reason, a logical reason that you can follow and understand, because in appealing to your heart, I've also got to include your mind, and I want to give you a reason that is intellectually satisfied. So come, says Jesus, let us reason together. Let's use our logic. Let's use our minds. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth. Why, Jesus? Why shouldn't I store up treasures on earth? Give me a reason. Because on earth, says Jesus, here's the reason, moth and rust destroy and thieves break in and steal. It's irrefutable, isn't it? That to me, I think, is I can't get around it. Can you get around it? It's absolutely logical. It's rock solid. It's airtight. Jesus is saying, if you place your treasures here on earth, they're not going to last. Why? Because on earth, things, your treasures, are prone to the ravages of moths, the ravages of rust, and the ravages of thieves. That's what the earth is like. That's what the world is like. In this world, there is moths, rust, and thieves. Everything in this world, says Jesus, is subject to decay. Nothing you have is going to last forever. Some people, it's not me particularly, thank you, you don't need to comment, but I don't particularly go for clothes. I mean, you know, one pair of jeans will do me, red usually, will do me. You know, but some people spend, you know, it's whatever floats your boat. Some people, I've got other things. Some people, you know, like clothes. Fine. So, you know, they very easily spend money in clothes because that's what they value, that's what they treasure. But that's fine, says Jesus, but understand that one day they'll fade. They'll become worn. They'll become torn. Moths will eventually consume them. And even if they don't, fashions change, don't they? Remember those expensive, fantastic pair of flared jeans? I mean, they used to be huge, didn't they? Platform shoes. Probably some of you still got them in your cupboards. But you don't dare wear them anymore. You spent a fortune on them, but you don't dare wear them. Why? Because fashions change. It's what the world is like that we live in. And then Jesus says, you know, there's not only that, there's this rust and that eats metal. You know, that Bentley, that fantastic car you've got, it's lovely. Sooner or later, rust is going to get in, it's going to consume it, and it's gone. Now, the word rust there in the Greek means to eat. eats it. Well, you can see, understand that rust eats precious metals. But there's also, I think, in Jesus' mind, because he brings it out in Luke 12, of this rich farmer who's got barns full of wheat and grain. And he says, take your ease, eat, drink, be merry. I've got all my goods stored up for many years. But one night rats come in and they consume, eat all the grain, all the barley. It's all gone overnight. It's all disappeared. And then Jesus says, there are also thieves. The diocese does it for the house, but some of you spend fortune on protecting your property, alarms, lights. Why? Thieves break in and steal. Now, says Jesus, think deeper. Those are all external threats. What about the internal threats to your wealth? You know what it's like. You buy something, you buy an iPad, you love it. There it is. One of the children have bought an iPad, and there it is. He's on it 24/7, tinkering away. After a bit, he's bored of it. Tired of it. Had it for a bit, satisfied him for a bit. He enjoyed it for a bit. Now, he's bored. Tired of it. Doesn't satisfy. Remember Jesus talking to the woman of Samaria. The woman at the well, searching for permanence, searching for relationships, searching for security. You've got 5 husbands, says Jesus. Don't you know anyone who drinks from this water will thirst again? Relationships are lovely, relationships are fine, but ultimately everyone's going to disappoint you. Nobody can fulfill that deep longing you have in your heart for a permanent, rock-solid relationship. All the most stable relationships you have, sooner or later, one day, the person will die and you're going to not be there anymore. Whoever drinks from this water will thirst again. Why do you set your store in this? Why do you treasure these things? Important they are, yes, fine. But it's not your treasure, can't be your treasure. It's not going to ultimately satisfy. And have you ever noticed as well, some children who come from very wealthy families, sometimes this happens. Children from very wealthy homes, they can be very bored. Lethargic, they have everything. Nothing concerns them. Nothing moves them. They're not concerned about the suffering of the world. They're too protected. They're too cosseted from it. This is the great argument at the moment about, you know, these pampered politicians. They don't live in the real world. They've got the millions behind them, and they just don't understand what the real world is like. They're out of touch. Also, says Jesus, he says, think about this. Think even further. Sometimes people who've got great wealth don't have any friends. Really, they don't have friends. I was reading a Buddhist theologian, just to show you that my reading is as ecumenical as possible. I was reading a Buddhist theologian, and he was speaking about the dangers. So this isn't just unique to Christianity. He's also speaking about the dangers of wealth. And he said, why is it that men and women of great wealth are often unattractive, socially incapable, acquisitive, and selfish? Well, you know, I wouldn't say that about everybody, but, you know, I've known some people who are rich who can be like that. Why is that? Says this Buddhist theologian. Let me quote you him. It says this, why should wealthy people even bother to try to be different? What could possibly motivate them to question the way they are? They do not tend to get the signals from social interaction that there's very much wrong with them. Quite the reverse, in fact, with so much money and other people's admiration. There is very little incentive for them to doubt the validity of their own behavior, their self-esteem, or their success in life. He went on to say, there is therefore a profound imbalance in their self-certainty, as if by right of birth they have all the answers and that their opinions are somehow sacred. There is not much strong motivation coming from their own side for them to bother to be any more polite, sociable, mature, humble, or kind than they are already. They do not doubt themselves enough. They have no humility and no affection for the common man. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal. I tell you what to do, lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Now, of course, this is all true, isn't it? I mean, can you fault the logic? Fault the logic for me. Speak to me afterwards and say, Vicar, I can see where Jesus made a fundamental mistake in his logic. I can't fault his logic. But there's another reason, a more profound reason, touched on by the psalmist. And he says, the psalmist, he's talking about men who make idols and who live after idols. Now, you'll say to me, well, I don't make idols. Well, idols are all the things that you really treasure and really value. Okay, so let's not think of painted statues. Let's think of the things that you really value, the things of this world, the materialist things, the things that we pursue, whatever it is. And the psalmist says these people, they worship idols, they worship money, they worship mammon. Money can't speak, he said. Money cannot see, money cannot hear, money cannot breathe. Money has no life in and of itself. Therefore, did you notice the logic of that psalmist? The psalmist argues that those who worship these things, who make money their treasure, who value the things of this world, you will become like the treasure you value. You will become like the things you value. As money is deaf and dumb and mute and indifferent, so will the people who worship that will become themselves blind, deaf, dumb, and indifferent. They will have eyes, but they will not see suffering. Mouths, but they will not be able to speak out against injustice. Ears, but not able to hear the cry of the unborn. The nations worship idols. Their idols are of silver and gold, made by the hands of men. They have mouths but cannot speak, eyes but they cannot see, ears but they cannot hear, noses but they cannot smell, hands but they can't feel, feet but they cannot walk, nor can they utter a sound with their throats. Those who make them will become like them, and so will all who trust in them. It's frightening, isn't it? Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. Seeking treasures on earth will never make you feel secure, because you'll never have enough. I don't think it's by mistake that as soon as Jesus talks about this, the next thing he's talking about is anxiety. Do not worry about your life, because if these are the things you're pursuing, they'll never make you secure enough. That woman at the well had five husbands, and still she wanted more. Whoever drinks from this well will thirst again, said Jesus. But these are the negative arguments. But Jesus also wants to be positive, doesn't he? He's appealing to the mind. So in the interest of balance, in the interest of being logical and fair, he says, now let me give you other reasons. Positive reasons. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth. Right? What you should do? Store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. I find that so intellectually satisfying, don't you? The balance is so lovely. Don't do this because of this reason. Do this because of this reason. Perfect. Lovely. Intellectually satisfying. But here Jesus is really cutting down to the quick. He's saying, store up for yourselves treasures. Now, let's think about this, because this is really important. You and I, all of us, says Jesus, you're all pursuing treasure. Don't tell me that you're not. You are. 7 days a week, every month of every year, Your heart is pursuing treasure. Your heart is inclining to the left, inclining to the right, searching for security, searching for stability, searching for something that's going to feed this aching void. And Jesus says, you know, it depends on what age you are, of course. When I was a young man, I had different treasures that I was pursuing. They change as you grow older, now that I'm less young than I was. I now value other things because my life has changed and I see things differently. So now I'm pursuing other things. I'm trying to make sure I've got some kind of pension before I retire. When I was 23, I didn't get pension. What's that? Never gave a moment's thought. As you grow older, you see, you start to change. And Jesus is saying, you see, all the time you've got to be awake to yourself. Wake it, understand who you truly are. Do you not see that you're pursuing treasures? Now, this is very, very difficult to admit for people. People like to think, no, I'm completely neutral. This came to me quite forcefully last week. I was reading an article in the Times by actually my favourite journalist. Well, one of my favourite journalists. He's very well educated, very erudite, very clever, very iconoclastic. I know you're all trying to work out who he is now, so I'll tell you. It's Matthew Paris. Very, very clever guy. And he did this lovely article in which he was complaining about the Bishop of Rochester. And he said, the Bishop of Rochester, this Orthodox Bible-believing bishop. The trouble is, the Bishop of Rochester has values. The Bishop of Rochester has treasures. The Bishop of Rochester has things that he treasures above everything else. And we think we should know what they are. He should come clean and say, I believe this because I believe in God. You see, I'm pursuing God. That's my treasure. I believe in sin. I believe in Christian doctrine. I believe in all these concerns. And says Matthew Paris, he should come out and tell us what motivates his heart, what is at the center of his being. Why do you want to do that? Well, so that we can say, that's what he believes, therefore puts to one side. And the whole implication, of course, is that Matthew Paris is completely neutral. Those are religious concerns. But he himself, completely neutral. Oh, really? What do you really value? You really value atheism. You really value individualism. This is what you're always writing about, the freedom of the individual. Because you put the individual above everything else. Now, Mr. Paris, please, let us know your concerns too so we can discount them. Because all of us have got concerns that are at the center of our heart. Don't just say that's religious people. Everybody does. Secularists have deep concerns that are at the center of their being. They also have their treasures. Come out with them too. Let's, for the sake of argument, let's have a level playing field. Everybody should declare their central concerns. Because nobody is neutral. Don't pretend there's such a thing as neutrality. There isn't. You have the things that colour your vision of the world. I have things that colour mine. So let's just come out and say what they are. And so Jesus says, let's admit this. Let's all confess now. Let's all admit that we're all pursuing treasure. Very well. That's good. Let's pursue the argument. Now, says Jesus, as we're all pursuing treasure, you're doing it, I'm doing it, we're all doing it, make sure that your treasure is in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. Wouldn't that be marvelous? Doesn't that make sense? Is that logical? Peter tells us that in heaven we have an inheritance. I love this. We have an inheritance that is incorruptible, undefiled, and it does not fade away, says Peter. And that treasure in heaven is being kept for you. It's being guarded for you by God, who you believe in him through faith. And therefore you have this treasure in heaven, and it's being kept in heaven for you. God is guarding it. It's incorruptible. In heaven there is no boredom, there is no apathy, there is no selfishness, there's no rust, there's nothing that pollutes or destroys. So Jesus says, lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Makes sense, doesn't it? You following the logic? Good. Because now Jesus changes tack. Oh, he's a way of pulling the rug out from under your feet. He says, okay, now, having talked about the mind, I'm now going to appeal to your will. Now that follows as well. That's also logical, isn't it? Because what you believe in your mind finds expression in your will. What you believe, you will act upon. Therefore, says Jesus, do not serve two masters. Because either you'll hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Now that's very clear. Now of course, we like to serve both. I do. I bet you do. Oh gosh, that's extreme. Let me take a little bit of God, a little bit of mammon, mix them up, and you know, I'll do a juggling act and balance throughout life, and yes, a bit of this and a bit of that, and mix the two kingdoms together, God and mammon. Yes, why not? A bit of both. Don't want to be too extreme, don't want to be too devoted, don't want to be too logical. Let's mix these two things together. Ah, says Jesus, you can't do it at the end. You cannot do it. Now let me just say one thing. Jesus isn't saying here, please do not get the view that Jesus is saying that wealth is evil. It's not. He's not saying that. In fact, Jesus was dependent himself on wealthy people to support him in his ministry. We read of Abraham also had great wealth. Job had great wealth. So Jesus is not, please do not think that Jesus is knocking wealth. He's not knocking wealth, but he's saying what he is knocking is if you put wealth and these things before God, because at the end of the day, you will not be able to serve both. You may think you can, but at the end of the day, you can't. Now, I had to think of an illustration for this, and I couldn't think of one, so I turned to Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones, who has a brilliant illustration. He said, you've got to understand that the money and God are both totalitarian. They demand everything from you. Your gods will demand everything from you. And he gives this brilliant illustration of a farmer. And this farmer has a cow, and she gives birth to two calves. One is red, and the other white. And he comes in full of piety, and he says to his wife, darling, the Lord has greatly blessed us. We have two calves, one red and one white, and I think we should let the two calves grow up together, and in 9 months' time, in a year's time, we'll sell one of the calves and give the money to the Lord. Oh, fine, says the farmer's wife. Which one? Well, we don't need to decide now. Well, let's just bring them up together, and in the course of time, we'll sell one and give the money away. Fine, says the wife. So off he goes, and 6 months later comes into the kitchen. He's very upset. Why are you upset, darling? Well, he says, the Lord's calf died. She says, what do you mean, the Lord's calf died? You weren't going to decide. You were going to bring the two up together, and you weren't going to decide one way or the other. I said, no, I always decided in my mind that it was the red calf, and the red calf died. Do you see what Jesus is saying? At the end, in the final analysis, when the chips are down, you will not be able to serve both God and mammon on the day of judgment, when the secrets of all our hearts will be revealed. The treasures of your heart will be exposed. Here on earth, you may think, oh, I can live for both. Don't push me so hard, vicar. Let me alone. Let me leave. Let me serve one and the other. Oh, I can't, because at the end of the day, what you really value, says Jesus, will come to light. I'll finish on this. We come now to the very heart of the passage. Jesus has been talking about the mind. He's been talking about the will. And now he talks about your eye, you see, your eye, which is the organ of spiritual insight. It's also the organ of physical insight, but light, spiritual light, comes in through the eye, doesn't it? And he says, if your eyes are good, your body is full of light. But if your eyes are blind, if they're full of cataracts and crystals and opaque and you cannot see, you'll be stumbling around in the dark. You'll be trying to serve God and mammon. You won't make it. You'll fall and collapse. And at the end of the day, you'll come to ruin. Because your eyes are not good. Well, how do you spiritually evaluate things? How do you evaluate what's really important? Is your eye good? Are you seeing clearly? Can you see what Jesus is saying? Can you rather see what Jesus has been doing? Sometimes people can't see Jesus or they don't understand Jesus because they're pursuing other treasure. People say this to me, "Oh, Vicar, I believe in Jesus." I say, "Good. Do you treasure him? I know you believe in him. Do you treasure him? Do you really value him?" Now, how do you get that? Well, you know, you've got to understand something. When somebody gives you a gift, I don't know what it is. Sometimes people in my life have given me very generous gifts, great gifts. Sometimes I've had debts that I can't pay, and a friend has come in and said, "Nigel, you know, I'll help you out." And it's great. As soon as that happens, when somebody does that for you, what happens to your heart towards that person? Well, you melt, don't you? You say, "Oh, God, thanks." And your heart goes out to that person, and you love them because they've given you this great gift. I remember the trouble is with gifts is they can give you a gift, and your heart melts, and you're very grateful, and you write your thank you letters and all the rest, and you're moved by it. But then as the weeks go by, you forget, don't you? I remember one of the best gifts I was given was he's a clever man. My father-in-law sent me a year's subscription to National Geographic. That's good. So every month a new National Geographic arrives at the vicarage. And every month you're reminded of the gift, and every month your heart is softened. Because you're reminded of the generosity of the person giving you the gift. Now Jesus says, I want you to think, well, actually Matthew tells us, think about Jesus. Think about what Jesus Christ has done. We've been following his life throughout the Gospel of Matthew. Jesus Christ, says Paul, Jesus Christ was rich, and yet he became poor for your sakes, so that you, through his poverty, you who are poor, you who are blind, might become rich, so that you can spiritually see. And says Matthew, look at what Jesus has done. He's come down from heaven. He's left his Father's throne above. He's left the adulation of angels. He was hugely wealthy in heaven. He had everything. He comes down into this world and he becomes poor. And what Jesus does is he recapitulates the whole history of fallen, cursed Israel. Because Jesus is, as he's born, there was persecution against him. He goes into Egypt because the people of Israel had gone into Egypt. And as just as the people of Israel came up out of Egypt, so Jesus comes up out of Egypt. The people of Israel then go through the Red Sea. They're baptized into the Red Sea. Jesus is then baptized by John in the River Jordan. The people of Israel then go for 40 years into the wilderness where they're tempted, and they fall. And Jesus then goes for 40 days into the wilderness where he is tempted, and he does not fall. Because Jesus now stands as the Savior of the world, speaking this Sermon on the Mount to the whole world, because all the crowds are gathered there. You are gathered there. You are here this morning hearing his words, and Jesus Christ is offering you eternal life. If you think about that, if you value that, if you treasure that, if you keep coming week after week after week, because you need to be reminded, just as I needed to be reminded of my father-in-law's generosity by receiving that National Geographic every week, so you need to be reminded by coming again and again and again, placing yourself under the sound of the gospel so that your heart is melted. And then you begin to understand that the treasures of this world will never satisfy. That if you drink from this water, you will thirst again. But if your treasure becomes Jesus Christ of Nazareth, you'll be laying up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. Where is your treasure? What do you really value? Oh, you can play around for a bit. God, mammon, God, mammon, mammon, God. Sooner or later, you will have to make a choice. And then your heart will be exposed. And I pray that on that day, you'll be seen to be treasuring Jesus Christ of Nazareth, the Savior of the world, the man who was rich who became poor for you, so that you who were poor could become unbelievably rich. Amen. Jesus said, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy, where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Well, we're in the Sermon on the Mount, as many of you know. We're looking at this central passage that encapsulates Jesus' teaching from Matthew chapter 5 through to verse 7. And as we've been saying, this sermon is well known by people. You don't necessarily have to be a Christian or a churchgoer to know the Sermon on the Mount. It still has traction in wider society. When you quote the Sermon on the Mount, people often know that it's the words of Jesus. And that's why, as I said some weeks ago, that's why politicians like Barack Obama and others, not just him, of course, others often quote the Sermon on the Mount, quote Jesus' saying, because they want the support of Jesus for some reason. They want the support of Jesus for their policies. It's not that they want to serve Jesus, they want Jesus to serve them. So they quote Jesus' words to, you know, say, well, this is what Jesus would have done. And they say that because, you know, the Sermon on the Mount still resonates in the wider society. But so it's well known. It's well known, but it's not known at the same time. It's a strange thing. You can know something well, but not know it. Because you may think you know something very well, but you don't know it at all. I think it was Alexander Pope, who once said, "A little knowledge is dangerous. It's apt to puff a man up." It's like teaching a teenager to drive, which I'm doing at the moment. They have 5 lessons. And all of a sudden they think they know everything. And they think that because they've had 5 lessons, it's quite all right for them to go out and drive 90 miles an hour up the motorway. A little knowledge, you see, makes them think they can do all sorts of things. It puffs people up. Francis Bacon also said the same. He said, a little philosophy, a little learning, inclines men's minds to atheism. A smattering of knowledge inclines men to unbelief. But he said, depth in philosophy brings men's minds about to religion. A little knowledge puffs up, a little knowledge leads to the deaths of teenagers in cars, a little knowledge leads men to unbelief, a superficial understanding of the Sermon on the Mount leads politicians to want to redefine age-old institutions like marriage, claiming that Jesus would support them. And that's why I think it's important that we spend some time in the Sermon on the Mount looking at it in some depth and in some detail. This will, first of all, if you're a Christian, will make you a real disciple or a better disciple of Jesus Christ. And if you're not Christian or you're not that familiar with the Sermon on the Mount, it'll get you to the heart of what Jesus is really saying. And in the passage today, in Matthew 6, we are getting to the heart of what Jesus was driving at. He says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. Store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." So Jesus is driving at your heart. He's concerned about your heart. He's concerned about your ultimate values. He's concerned about the things that are most precious and dear to you. And he says, therefore, where your treasure is, there is your heart. So where is your heart, ladies and gentlemen? Where is your treasure? What are you really valuing in this life? What are you really trusting? Jesus is very concerned about this. And the reason he's very concerned about this is because on the day of judgment, what Jesus is saying is that the disposition and inclination of your heart will ultimately and finally and completely define and determine your relationship with the one living and true God. Now, I can't get more serious than that. Don't think Jesus could either, really. I could actually fine-tune it. I could make it more direct, even more personal, because what Jesus is talking about is not your relationship to God, although he is talking about that. What he's ultimately saying is, what is your heart's relationship with me? With me. How do you evaluate? How do you value me? Because your relationship to me will ultimately determine your everlasting destiny. That's serious. Serious. And so Jesus is going after our hearts. And he does that because what he's trying to do is he's trying to wean us off what our hearts naturally go after, what your heart and my heart naturally goes after. Because he says our desires, our hearts, what you treasure, what you value, showcase and display your ultimate concerns. And so he starts to go after our hearts. And he starts to go after it negatively. He starts off negatively, doesn't he? He says, do not store up for yourselves. That's negative. Don't do that. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. And then he says that. He says, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth. And then because he's going after your mind, well, he's going after your heart, but your mind is one aspect of your heart. Your mind, your rational thinking, your ability to think and reason is part of your overall heart, you see. So Jesus says, I'm going to give you a reason. I'm not just going to say something. I'm not just going to say, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth. I'm going to give you a reason. A logical reason. That you can follow and understand. Because in appealing to your heart, I've also got to include your mind. And I want to give you a reason that is intellectually satisfied. So come, says Jesus, let us reason together. Let's use our logic. Let's use our minds. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth. Why, Jesus? Why shouldn't I store up treasures on earth? Give me a reason. Because on earth, says Jesus, here's the reason. Moth and rust destroy and thieves break in and steal. It's irrefutable, isn't it? That to me, I think, is I can't get around it. Can you get around it? It's absolutely logical. It's rock solid. It's airtight. Jesus is saying, if you place your treasures here on earth, they're not going to last. Why? Because on earth, things, your treasures, are prone to the ravages of moths, the ravages of rust, and the ravages of thieves. That's what the earth is like. That's what the world is like. In this world, there is moths, rust, and thieves. Everything in this world, says Jesus, is subject to decay. Nothing you have is going to last forever. Some people, it's not me particularly, thank you, you don't need to comment, but I don't particularly go for clothes. I mean, you know, one pair of jeans will do me, red usually, will do me. You know, but some people spend, you know, it's whatever floats your boat. Some people, I've got other things. Some people, you know, like clothes. Fine. So, you know, they very easily spend money in clothes because that's what they value, that's what they treasure. But that's fine, says Jesus, but understand that one day they'll fade. They'll become worn. They'll become torn. Moths will eventually consume them. And even if they don't, fashions change, don't they? Remember those expensive, fantastic pair of flared jeans? I mean, they used to be huge, didn't they? Probably some of you still got them in your cupboards. But you don't dare wear them anymore. You spent a fortune on them, but you don't dare wear them. Why? Because fashions change. It's what the world is like that we live in. And then Jesus says, you know, there's not only that, there's this rust and that eats metal. It, you know, that Bentley, that fantastic car you've got, it's lovely. Sooner or later, rust is going to get in, it's going to consume it, and it's gone. Now, the word rust there in the Greek means to eat. Eats it. Well, you can see, understand that rust eats precious metals. But there's also, I think, in Jesus' mind, because he brings it out in Luke 12, of this rich farmer who's got barns full of wheat and grain. And he says, take your ease, eat, drink, be merry. I've got all my goods stored up for many years. But one night rats come in and they consume, eat all the grain, all the barley. It's all gone. Overnight, it's all disappeared. And then Jesus says, there are also thieves. The diocese does it for the house, but some of you spend fortune on protecting your property, alarms, lights. Why? Thieves break in and steal. Now, says Jesus, think deeper. Those are all external threats. What about the internal threats to your wealth? You know what it's like. You buy something, you buy an iPad, you love it. There it is. One of the children have bought an iPad, and there it is. He's on it 24/7, tinkering away. After a bit, he's bored of it. Tired of it. Had it for a bit, satisfied him for a bit. He enjoyed it for a bit. Now, he's bored. Tired of it. Doesn't satisfy. Remember Jesus talking to the woman of Samaria. The woman at the well, searching for permanence, searching for relationships, searching for security. You've got 5 husbands, says Jesus. Don't you know anyone who drinks from this water will thirst again? Relationships are lovely, relationships are fine, but ultimately everyone's going to disappoint you. Nobody can fulfill that deep longing you have in your heart for a permanent, rock-solid relationship. All the most stable relationships you have, sooner or later, one day, the person will die and you're going to not be there anymore. Whoever drinks from this water will thirst again. Why do you set your store in this? Why do you treasure these things? Important they are, yes, fine. But it's not your treasure, can't be your treasure. It's not going to ultimately satisfy. And have you ever noticed as well, some children who come from very wealthy families, sometimes this happens. Children from very wealthy homes, they can be very bored. Lethargic, they have everything. Nothing concerns them. Nothing moves them. They're not concerned about the suffering of the world. They're too protected. They're too cosseted from it. This is the great argument at the moment about, you know, these pampered politicians. They don't live in the real world. They've got the millions behind them, and they just don't understand what the real world is like. They're out of touch. Also, says Jesus, he says, think about this. Think even further. Sometimes people who've got great wealth don't have any friends. Really, they don't have friends. I was reading a Buddhist theologian, just to show you that my reading is as ecumenical as possible. I was reading a Buddhist theologian, and he was speaking about the dangers. So this isn't just unique to Christianity, he's also speaking about the dangers of wealth. And he said, why is it that men and women of great wealth are often unattractive, socially incapable, acquisitive and selfish? Well, you know, I wouldn't say that about everybody, but, you know, I've known some people who are rich who can be like that. Why is that? Says this Buddhist theologian. Let me quote you him. It says this: why should wealthy people even bother to try to be different? What could possibly motivate them to question the way they are? They do not tend to get the signals from social interaction that there is very much wrong with them. Quite the reverse, in fact, with so much money and other people's admiration. There's very little incentive for them to doubt the validity of their own behavior, their self-esteem, or their success in life. He went on to say, there is therefore a profound imbalance in their self-certainty, as if by right of birth they have all the answers and that their opinions are somehow sacred. There is not much strong motivation coming from their own side for them to bother to be any more polite, sociable, mature, humble, or kind than they are already. They do not doubt themselves enough. They have no humility and no affection for the common man. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal. I tell you what to do, lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Now, of course, this is all true, isn't it? I mean, can you fault the logic? Fault the logic for me. Speak to me often and say, Vicar, I can see where Jesus made a fundamental mistake in his logic. I can't fault his logic. But there's another reason, a more profound reason, touched on by the psalmist. And he says this, the psalmist, he's talking about men who make idols and who live after idols. Now, you'll say to me, well, I don't make idols. Well, idols are all the things that you really treasure and really value. Okay, so let's not think of painted statues. Let's think of the things that you really value, the things of this world, the materialist things, the things that we pursue, whatever it is. And the psalmist says these people, they worship idols, they worship money, they worship mammon. Money can't speak, he said. Money cannot see, money cannot hear, money cannot breathe. Money has no life in and of itself. Therefore, did you notice the logic of that psalmist? The psalmist argues that those who worship these things, who make money their treasure, who value the things of this world, you will become like the treasure you value. You will become like the things you value. As money is deaf and dumb and mute and indifferent, so will the people who worship that will become themselves blind, deaf, dumb, and indifferent. They will have eyes, but they will not see suffering. Mouths, but they will not be able to speak out against injustice. Ears, but not able to hear the cry of the unborn. The nations worship idols. Their idols are of silver and gold, made by the hands of men. They have mouths but cannot speak, eyes but they cannot see, ears but they cannot hear, noses but they cannot smell, hands but they can't feel, feet but they cannot walk, nor can they utter a sound with their throats. Those who make them will become like them, and so will all who trust in them. It's frightening, isn't it? Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. Seeking treasures on earth will never make you feel secure, because you'll never have enough. I don't think it's by mistake that as soon as Jesus talks about this, the next thing he's talking about is anxiety. Do not worry about your life, because if these are the things you're pursuing, they'll never make you secure enough. That woman at the well had five husbands, and still she wanted more. Whoever drinks from this well will thirst again, said Jesus. But these are the negative arguments. But Jesus also wants to be positive, doesn't he? He's appealing to the mind. So in the interest of balance, in the interest of being logical and fair, he says, now let me give you other reasons, positive reasons. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth. Right? What you should do, store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. I find that so intellectually satisfying, don't you? The balance is so lovely. Don't do this because of this reason. Do this because of this reason. Perfect. Lovely. Intellectually satisfying. But here Jesus is really cutting down to the quick. He's saying, store up for yourselves treasures. Now, let's think about this, because this is really important. You and I, all of us, says Jesus, you're all pursuing treasure. Don't tell me that you're not. You are. 7 days a week, every month of every year, your heart is pursuing treasure. Your heart is inclining to the left, inclining to the right, searching for security, searching for stability, searching for something that's going to feed this aching void. And Jesus says, you know, it depends on what age you are, of course. When I was a young man, I had different treasures that I was pursuing. They change as you grow older, now that I'm less young than I was. I now value other things because my life has changed and I see things differently. So now I'm pursuing other things. I'm trying to make sure I've got some kind of pension before I retire. When I was 23, I didn't get pension. What's that? Never gave a moment's thought. As you grow older, you see, you start to change. And Jesus is saying, you see, all the time you've got to be awake to yourself. Wake, understand who you truly are. Do you not see that you're pursuing treasures? Now, this is very, very difficult to admit for people. People like to think, no, I'm completely neutral. This came to me quite forcefully last week. I was reading an article in the Times by actually my favorite journalist. Well, one of my favorite journalists. He's very well educated, very erudite, very clever, very iconoclastic. I know you're all trying to work out who he is now, so I'll tell you. It's Matthew Paris. Very, very clever guy. And he was, this lovely article in which he was complaining about the Bishop of Rochester. And he said, the Bishop of Rochester, this Orthodox Bible-believing bishop. The trouble is, the Bishop of Rochester has values. The Bishop of Rochester has treasures. The Bishop of Rochester has things that he treasures above everything else. And we think we should know what they are. He should come clean and say, I believe this because I believe in God. You see, I'm pursuing God. That's my treasure. I believe in sin. I believe in Christian doctrine. I believe in all these concerns. And says Matthew Paris, he should come out and tell us what motivates his heart. What is at the center of his being. Why? Why do you want to do that? Well, so that we can say, that's what he believes, therefore puts to one side. And the whole implication, of course, is that Matthew Paris is completely neutral. Those are religious concerns. But he himself, completely neutral. Oh, really? What do you really value? You really value atheism. You really value individualism. This is what you're always writing about, the freedom of the individual. Because you put the individual above everything else. Now, Mr. Paris, please, let us know your concerns too so we can discount them. Because all of us have got concerns that are at the center of our heart. Don't just say that's religious people. Everybody does. Secularists have deep concerns that are at the center of their being. They also have their treasures. Come out with them too. Let's, for the sake of argument, let's have a level playing field. Everybody should declare their central concerns. Because nobody is neutral. Don't pretend there's such a thing as neutrality. There isn't. You have the things that color your vision of the world. I have things that color mine. So let's just come out and say what they are. And so Jesus says, let's admit this. Let's all confess now. Let's all admit that we're all pursuing treasure very well. That's good. Let's pursue the argument. Now, says Jesus, as we're all pursuing treasure, you're doing it, I'm doing it, we're all doing it, make sure that your treasure is in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. Wouldn't that be marvelous? Doesn't that make sense? Is that logical? Peter tells us that in heaven we have an inheritance. I love this. We have an inheritance that is incorruptible, undefiled, and it does not fade away, says Peter. And that treasure in heaven is being kept for you. It's being guarded for you by God, who you believe in Him through faith. And therefore you have this treasure in heaven, and it's being kept in heaven for you. God is guarding it. It's incorruptible. In heaven, there is no boredom. There is no apathy. There is no selfishness. There's no rust. There's nothing that pollutes or destroys. So Jesus says, lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Makes sense, doesn't it? You following the logic? Good. Because now Jesus changes tack. Oh, he's a way of pulling the rug out from under your feet. He says, okay, now, having talked about the mind, I'm now going to appeal to your will. Now that follows as well. That's also logical, isn't it? Because what you believe in your mind finds expression in your will. What you believe, you will act upon. Therefore, says Jesus, do not serve two masters. Because either you'll hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the one, the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Now that's very clear. Now of course, we like to serve both. I do. I bet you do. Oh gosh, that's extreme. Let me take a little bit of God, a little bit of mammon, mix them up, and you know, I'll do a juggling act and balance throughout life, and yes, a bit of this and a bit of that, and mix the two kingdoms together, God and mammon. Yes, why not? A bit of both. Don't want to be too extreme, don't want to be too devoted, don't want to be too logical. Let's mix these two things together. Ah, says Jesus, you can't do it at the end. You cannot do it. Now let me just say one thing. Jesus isn't saying here, please do not get the view that Jesus is saying that wealth is evil. It's not. He's not saying that. In fact, Jesus was dependent himself on wealthy people to support him in his ministry. We read of Abraham also had great wealth. Job had great wealth. So Jesus is not, please do not think that Jesus is knocking wealth. He's not knocking wealth, but he's saying what he is knocking is if you put wealth and these things before God, because at the end of the day, you will not be able to serve both. You may think you can, but at the end of the day, you can't. Now, I had to think of an illustration for this, and I couldn't think of one, so I turned to Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones, who has a brilliant illustration. He said, you've got to understand that the money and God are both totalitarian. They demand everything from you. Your gods will demand everything from you. And he gives this brilliant illustration of a farmer. And this farmer has a cow, and she gives birth to two calves. One is red, and the other white. And he comes in full of piety, and he says to his wife, darling, the Lord has greatly blessed us. We have two calves, one red and one white, and I think we should let the two calves grow up together, and in 9 months' time, in a year's time, we'll sell one of the calves and give the money to the Lord. Oh, fine, says the farmer's wife. Which one? Well, we don't need to decide now. Well, let's just bring them up together, and in the course of time, we'll sell one and give the money away. Fine, says the wife. So off he goes, and 6 months later, comes into the kitchen. He's very upset. Why are you upset, darling? Well, he says, the Lord's calf died. She says, what do you mean, the Lord's calf died? You weren't going to decide. You were going to bring the two up together, and you weren't going to decide one way or the other. I said, no, I always decided in my mind that it was the red calf, and the red calf died. Do you see what Jesus is saying? At the end, in the final analysis, when the chips are down, you will not be able to serve both God and mammon on the day of judgment when the secrets of all our hearts will be revealed. The treasures of your heart will be exposed. Here on earth, you may think, oh, I can live for both. Don't push me so hard, vicar. Let me alone. Let me serve one and the other. Oh, I can't, because at the end of the day, what you really value, says Jesus, will come to light. I'll finish on this. We come now to the very heart of the passage. Jesus has been talking about the mind. He's been talking about the will. And now he talks about your eye, you see, your eye, which is the organ of spiritual insight. It's also the organ of physical insight, but light, spiritual light, comes in through the eye, doesn't it? And he says, if your eyes are good, your body is full of light. But if your eyes are blind, if they're full of cataracts and crystals and opaque and you cannot see, you'll be stumbling around in the dark. You'll be trying to serve God and mammon. You won't make it. You'll fall and collapse. And at the end of the day, you'll come to ruin. Because your eyes are not good. Well, how do you spiritually evaluate things? How do you evaluate what's really important? Is your eye good? Are you seeing clearly? Can you see what Jesus is saying? Can you rather see what Jesus has been doing? Sometimes people can't see Jesus, or they don't understand Jesus, because they're pursuing other treasure. People say this to me, "Oh, Vicar, I believe in Jesus." I say, "Good. Do you treasure him? I know you believe in him. Do you treasure him? Do you really value him?" Now, how do you get that? Well, you know, you've got to understand something. When somebody gives you a gift, I don't know what it is. Sometimes people in my life have given me very generous gifts, great gifts. Sometimes I've had debts that I can't pay, and a friend has come in and said, "Nigel, you know, I'll help you out." And it's great. As soon as that happens, when somebody does that for you, what happens to your heart towards that person? Well, you melt, don't you? You say, "Oh, God, thanks." And your heart goes out to that person, and you love them because they've given you this great gift. I remember the trouble is with gifts is they can give you a gift, and your heart melts, and you're very grateful, and you write your thank you letters and all the rest, and you're moved by it. But then as the weeks go by, you forget, don't you? I remember one of the best gifts I was given was he's a clever man. My father-in-law sent me a year subscription to National Geographic. That's good. So every month a new National Geographic arrives at the vicarage. And every month you're reminded of the gift, and every month your heart is softened. Because you're reminded of the generosity of the person giving you the gift. Now Jesus says, I want you to think, well, actually Matthew tells us, think about Jesus. Think about what Jesus Christ has done. We've been following his life throughout the Gospel of Matthew. Jesus Christ, says Paul, Jesus Christ was rich, and yet he became poor for your sakes, so that you, through his poverty, you who are poor, you who are blind, might become rich, so that you can spiritually see. And says Matthew, look at what Jesus has done. He's come down from heaven. He's left his Father's throne above. He's left the adulation of angels. He was hugely wealthy in heaven. He had everything. He comes down into this world and he becomes poor. And what Jesus does is he recapitulates the whole history of fallen, cursed Israel. Because Jesus is, as he's born, there was persecution against him. He goes into Egypt because the people of Israel had gone into Egypt. And just as the people of Israel came up out of Egypt, so Jesus comes up out of Egypt. The people of Israel then go through the Red Sea. They're baptized into the Red Sea. Jesus is then baptized by John in the River Jordan. The people of Israel then go for 40 years into the wilderness where they're tempted, and they fall. And Jesus then goes for 40 days into the wilderness where he is tempted, and he does not fall. Because Jesus now stands as the Savior of the world, speaking this Sermon on the Mount to the whole world, because all the crowds are gathered there. You are gathered there. You are here this morning hearing his words, and Jesus Christ is offering you eternal life. If you think about that, if you value that, If you treasure that, if you keep coming week after week after week, because you need to be reminded, just as I needed to be reminded of my father-in-law's generosity by receiving that National Geographic every week, so you need to be reminded by coming again and again and again, placing yourself under the sound of the gospel so that your heart is melted. And then you begin to understand that the treasures of this world will never satisfy. That if you drink from this water, you will thirst again. But if your treasure becomes Jesus Christ of Nazareth, you'll be laying up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. Where is your treasure? What do you really value? Oh, you can play around for a bit. God, mammon, God, mammon, mammon, God. Sooner or later, you will have to make a choice. And then your heart will be exposed. And I pray that on that day, you'll be seen to be treasuring Jesus Christ of Nazareth, the Savior of the world, the man who was rich who became poor for you, so that you who were poor could become unbelievably rich. Amen.